Welcome to the Volterra podcast number 6. I'm Rowan Kane. I'm here with Louis Reeve. How are we doing, Louis?
We're great, Rowan. How are you going?
Good to hear. Some technical difficulties to start the show. I'm also here, our first guest appearance, Ben Schreckinger, a friend of mine for about 13, 14 years. How we doing, Ben?
Doing good. Thanks for having me, Rowan.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Ben, we're going to get right into it. Ben is a freelance writer. He's had a bunch of articles posted on various news sources. And his latest one is about Unovation. And if I get this correct, Unovation is kind of going back to ways that worked in the past. Is that right, Ben?
Yeah, it's going back to economic strategies that aren't particularly innovative, but still have sort of untapped value. And I was writing about it specifically for New England, but it can apply anywhere.
And how did you start this project?
Sure. So I started by just sort of surveying the New England economy. I'd been talking to an editor at the Globe about the fact that outside of Route 128, which is the Boston area, and the southwest suburbs of New York, which are really dependent on finance and part of the New York economy, New England's economy is a little bit moribund. There aren't many places that are doing as badly as Appalachia or other parts of the country, but there's not a lot of vibrancy in a lot of these old industrial cities, which in Massachusetts are called gateway cities, places like Lawrence and land-based economies, and as well as parts of rural New England that used to have more farming, and now, especially in the northernmost parts of Maine, are more abundant. And what I found was that there, in Massachusetts, for example, over the next decade, because of an aging manufacturing workforce, the state's no longer losing manufacturing jobs. But as the workforce ages out, there's going to be about 100,000 new jobs just in this state in the next 10 years or so. And they can't recruit people to fill these good jobs, some of which pay, high five figures, good middle-class jobs, because can't find young people to go into manufacturing, even if they don't have, better prospects in the low-skilled service sector. And what I found with agriculture is that there's a lot of room for growth in local agriculture. There are a ton of reasons that this region should be producing more of its own food. But local, small-scale, sustainable agriculture sort of has this image as a hobby for affluent whites or hippies or whatever it is. And so it's not being taken so seriously as an economic strategy when there is a lot of room for growth there.
Yeah. So was this a topic that you had kind of, wanted to look at before? Did you just kind of see a story there and knew that it was a good topic to write about? Like, what drew you to the topic in the first place?
Sure. So,
and I ask that because I'm trying to write. Louis is a writer as well, and just kind of that finding the stories is always the writing can often be the easiest part of it. It's finding the topics that you want to write about.
Sure, absolutely. And in this case, so I had been given a book called Deep Economy by Bill McKibben when I graduated high school. And a lot of that is about, or in New England, and making the case for this form of agriculture as just a superior alternative to a lot of the industrial agriculture and monoculture that makes up most of the American food supply. And so that's something that I've been tossing around in my head for, 6 years at this point, and something that I've always been interested in. And in terms of looking at the New England economy for this specific piece, this was sort of a vague idea of an editor who reached out to me and said, you know, hey, we want you to write for us, and we're not really sure what about, but, like, what about this issue of the New England economy and its woes outside of the Boston area? And so I just started reading deeply into that, and I guess I had this agricultural component in the back of my head. And a big report came out, was released in June by a bunch of academics at Brandeis and UVM and UNH and a few other places, that was calling for a tripling of acreage under cultivation in New England. It was basically calling for New England to go from producing currently 15% of its own food to half of its own food. So there was a peg there, and just in terms of looking at the gateway cities and the loss of manufacturing, that became apparent over the course of the research. And then the innovation, just the – I had been thinking about that angle sort of from the beginning of research, the turning back to older economic strategies and the fact that there is a lot of hype in Boston around its innovation economy, which is fine. Innovation has been really, really great for Boston, of course, but just the issue that the hype around it may be detracting from other promising strategies. And then the innovation, little pun is something that I sort of gave it my own definition.
Your own twist. So, Louis, I want to bring you in on this. Having heard that kind of explanation, what are your kind of thoughts on this? Because this the New England economy what often looked a lot like the British economy in a lot of ways.
Right. Okay. Right.
Yeah. So have a whack at it, I guess.
I know precious little about the New England economy or food production in the United States, to be honest. I actually know very little about regular or original England economy, which is where I live, I suppose. So it's quite a bad thing. I guess I'm all for, like, going back to some sort of pre-industrialized way of doing things. I'm happy to pay for stuff with beans or eggs. It's of no issue. If I need petrol, I'll happily pay for it in milk. If I had a cow, that's about all I could really contribute in terms of statistics. I don't know a lot about what goes on here. We have a sort of confusing arrangement with the EU in this whole free trade in Europe, which means that a lot of people that produce stuff here produce it for the sake of producing it and are then subsidized. So farmers really don't do a hell of a lot in a lot of places in Britain. It's not really the hard graft that it used to be. It's just sort of, yeah, we have a big problem with kind of the wastage of food. It's easier to make loads of butter and then just throw it away, and you'll get paid more than if you sold it as butter, if that makes sense. But that's how the world works around here. So that's I guess, how it's probably going to stay. In terms of New England, I don't know. I guess you've hit the nail on the head there. But sure. Hey.
Yeah, so that's actually brings up an interesting point in terms of regulation and in terms of how much we can actually go back to that at this point with the economy the way it's structured now.
Sure.
So Ben, have you had any issue or have you seen any problems in terms of regulation keeping this from happening?
Sure. The most important government policy that's standing in the way of small scale sustainable production, especially in New England, is federal subsidies for food, which go predominantly to the Midwest, places west of the Mississippi. They go to keeping farmers from growing food. They go to subsidizing soy and corn and then cattle. And so basically what you have is New England is flooded with subsidized low-quality food, which just puts any local farmer at a competitive disadvantage. And these subsidies are massive. It's on the scale of hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, in the course of a decade. And so the food system is completely, completely distorted by these government subsidies. One of the outrageous things about the fact that we're paying farmers not to grow food is that that's meant to prop up food prices. One thing is that we're heading towards higher food prices anyways, because climate change, water depletion, they're all going to put a lot of stress on the food system. And also, the thing is, we're getting low-quality food at a high price, you know. So if you get rid of these subsidies, there's room for higher – the price to rise on quality, you know. The price of food isn't – the floor is not going to fall out of it. Because if you get rid of these subsidies, it's going to open the door for small-scale, diversified agriculture that's more expensive but also – just higher quality all around.
Yeah. So, Louis, have you seen any of this kind of like local agriculture in the shops in the UK at all? Because I mean, I remember in St. Andrews there was like the Balgove Larder, and there were certain areas, there were certain shops that you could get like locally produced stuff. But you, like you said, it was a lot of to do with like butter and like maybe a few cabbages and stuff and turnips. And I guess that's what Scottish agriculture is.
Yeah, like the crap stuff that nobody wants to cook with.
Right. It is kind of in vogue in some. I mean, like you weren't there when Mitchell's turned into whatever it was. It's a new like high end place. But I mean, in London, there must be these kind of high end places that locally.
Oh yeah, like absolutely. I mean, London does have like quite a big culture of this whole. We have Whole Foods now in London, so that's like, you know, it's pretty international in terms of if you want to get broccoli for like three times the price of what it usually costs in like regular shops. I think that's basically what it is. I, due to my like Scottish genes, I'm kind of unable to pay any more than is the minimum price, especially for vegetables. So. That's something that I've always found quite difficult, but it's hereditary, so there's nothing I can do about it. Completely genetic. But London is starting to get peppered with the kind of... I would personally refer to it as kind of like wanky shops, but that's just me. They probably do actually quite nice produce. And my girlfriend, who is like Danish and far more... liberal-minded when it comes to buying food, because she like has noticed that if you do spend money on it, it tastes a lot better than microwave lasagna from Tesco, for example, which I think tastes fine, but it's not my decision if she's cooking, you know. To answer the question, sort of to sum it up there for you, it is quite a big thing in London. Though I've been in Edinburgh now for a couple of days, and it's really not quite reached as far north yet.
Really? Okay.
I mean, we have, like, farmers markets, which are an opportunity for people to sell you really old pies with, a zany filling, like pheasant or something like that, for loads of money. And that's basically what they seem to do. Or, like, potatoes that are so dirty, you cannot clean them no matter how hard you scrub.
You need a power washer to take care of the business.
Yeah.
So do you think, like, this can go to either of you. Do you think this is a kind of just a trend in food, or is this the way, like, the direction food is going, and it's just a process in terms of driving down prices and making it open to not just rich white people?
I don't think it's a fad. I think that it starts out looking like a fad. It sounds like in the British Isles, it's like a little, it's almost like where the state of this was in the States maybe 5 or more years ago, where it's newer, so it's only on the fringes, it's very high end, there's no economy of scale. And in the US, slowly you're seeing it pick up a little bit more momentum in pockets of the country and hitting some more scale. There's a guy who lives in my town who's related to some of my friends, who's just finished raising a venture capital fund specifically aimed at creating financial infrastructure for really scaling out local sustainable food production. So they're financing things like distribution, you know, companies that are finding ways to just make a more efficient pipeline between farms and households. And so I think that the logic in favor of this in terms of the security of the food supply, in terms of like human health is too overwhelming. I think that if you look at historically from the Middle Ages down to 2014, what the percentage of income that's going to food has steadily been declining. I think it's gone too far, at least in the States. Not enough of our income is going to food, so we're getting cheap, shitty food. So I think people can afford to pay a little bit more for food than they do now, and that the price of this kind of food is going to keep falling, and that it's not a fad.
Yeah. So going into that kind of driving down of prices, is there a way that A, people like Louis, who don't want to spend any more money on food, can get into the process, and B, those that are in like in dire poverty and in persistent poverty, give them access to these kind of foods? Because I mean I know Louis doesn't like to spend a lot of money, and he's not the richest guy in the world, but he's also not the poorest guy in the world either.
He's not turned like Orwellian yet. We're okay.
Exactly. So is there a way, like either of you, like Louis, what would make you, is it just literally prices dropping, or is it more to do with...
Interesting. I mean, yeah, I guess part of it would be having a job that paid enough and didn't maybe want to kill myself every day. And then I'd probably happily buy broccoli at £3 a... I don't even know what the technical term for a tree of broccoli is. But so that'd be fine. I guess it's kind of like an attitude thing. Even I, like, because I'm sort of quite heavily influenced by popular culture, since all these, like, documentaries by Michael Moore clones have come out in the last sort of 10 years about factory farming and stuff, like, and then we had the scandal in Britain of, like, all sort of prepackaged meat contain like quite a lot of horse, so you end up eating the fucking cast of sea biscuit over like the course of a year, and it's pretty disconcerting. Not that I'd care, like if they labelled it as horse, I'd be happy to eat it. But they, you know, they didn't, and it was a bit like grim. And yeah, as I say, you know, people will start getting kind of exposed to these documentaries, and we have had a couple of like farmyard animal epidemics recently, with sort of post-apocalyptic scenes of burning pigs on the motorway, sorry, the highway for you guys. Yeah, I guess it's more of an attitude thing. I suppose I'd eventually get round to spending all the odds on food.
And Ben, what about the poverty issue? Are there innovative ways for innovation to get to poverty, I guess you could say?
In terms of allowing poor people to buy this food or to consume this food?
Yeah.
Sure. So I guess big picture, like anything that's going to be more expensive, affluent people are going to be, you know, the biggest group of people that get to adopt it first. And it's going to take a long time to trickle down to poor communities. That being said, in the States, there are initiatives to go into the inner cities and teach them about fresh food, give them supply of fresh food. There's like urban farming initiatives that try to create like community gardens that create food in inner city neighborhoods, and initiatives to get farmers markets in there. And so it's something that is happening to some extent in the States, but I think it's sort of just a broader truth about our society that if you're creating a better product that costs more, it's always going to be hard for people to be among the first to reap the benefits of it.
So we've been focusing a lot on the agriculture aspect of it, because that's where my kind of interests lie. My family actually take some of those subsidies from the federal government to farm cotton and soy in Missouri. I guess we are partially guilty for the lack of agriculture in New England. On the other hand, I would love to start a, I'm the typical rich white kid who wants to start a farm in somewhere in New England and use sustainable agriculture and be able to make somewhat of a profit off of it as well. I think that'd be a great kind of project and a really fun thing to do. But turning to the manufacturing aspect of it, there is surprising. I mean, I live in the kind of just outside that belt that you were talking about, and there's a surprising amount of manufacturing outside that belt, the Southwest Connecticut and New York, and then around Boston. Outside of there, there is a surprising amount of manufacturing. There used to be even more manufacturing. So, 10 miles from where I live is Waterbury, which used to be called the Brass City, which is basically all the brass in the country and close to the world was made in Waterbury. And now all that's gone, and there's the whole the what's called the Valley in Connecticut, the Housatonic River Valley, is all destitute, kind of post-manufacturing, massive empty brick buildings that are just kind of eyesores. And there's so much opportunity for these old buildings, old communities, old manufacturing communities to have more, to have investment in the community, in the potential there. So Ben, I don't know if you want to add anything on to that. I know Lowell is right up the street from you. I mean, my dad grew up in Peabody where the leather factories used to be. New England is pockmarked with old brick buildings that are decrepit and used to be factories.
Yeah, so, and well, there's one thing that's pretty well established, which is that the manufacturing jobs have stopped leaving. There was about 30 years where New England was hemorrhaging manufacturing jobs at a greater rate than the country on average, and that stopped years ago. And so now there's definitely going to be about this 100,000 people in Massachusetts, that 100,000 jobs that are going to need to be filled. And the bigger question is whether New England has the potential to add more manufacturing capacity. And, I heard from a guy in Hartford who's at a small, like, high-end shoemaker in Hartford that's a little startup. Yep. And so there are these tiny little signs of life in terms of what you might call, like, bespoke boutique manufacturing that could have a comeback in New England as well. But I think that it's early days for that, so it's hard to say if that's going to become significant anyway.
Yeah. Lou, do you want to add anything else to this? Because I think we're going to segue to
Sure. I mean, it's an admirable cause you guys kind of pursue. I guess you've got a bigger kind of endemic problem with you've got a lot more people there than we do here, which is one thing. And also your fast food is incredibly cheap. So when you can feed a family of like 7 people at Sonic or Wendy's for like $20 or whatever it costs, it's going to take some pretty heavy-handed expansion to kind of break the mold of that, so to speak. But I wish you all the best of luck. And
So another area that has a somewhat undeveloped economy thus far, and used to be a center of manufacturing and to some extent agriculture, is Scotland. And we promised last week that we would talk about a little bit about Scottish independence. The Scottish independence vote is coming up on the September 14th, right?
September 18th. September 18th. Yeah.
So just over a month away.
No, less.
Just under a month away.
Yeah.
So Louis, you're in Scotland. What's the report?
Well, it's kind of what's the symptomatic of the apathy that I thought was probably the case, where as with your issues with kind of middle class white guys doing, you know, trying to do a being very passionate about farming, agriculture, and production, the yes and the no campaign here are very much geared towards the kind of middle class Scot, of which there isn't actually that many, but that seems to be who's really getting into it. So the problem is they keep doing these polls where they interview kind of 1,000 middle class Scots around the kind of suburban Edinburgh area, and they come up with this statistic of however that comes out, and it's 50-50 or it doesn't matter at all, because the people they've asked are either yes or no. They're very kind of divided, and you don't get a very good picture from asking middle class Scots about Scotland, because we don't really know very much. We still like battered food, but you know, it's sort of, you know, more of a novelty thing for us. So there, I have this feeling that there's a large proportion of the Scottish populace, of which there's very few, just to let you know. There's less than 5 million of us, so it's a pretty small country. And I think the technical term is they don't give a fuck at all whether Scotland becomes independent or not, because they don't care about the things that the yes or the no campaign are promising or not promising or whatever they're doing. They're just quite happy to kind of like live their life, and as long as they've got enough on a Friday night to kind of, it sounds quite patronizing, but I feel it too, you know, enough on a Friday night to go out, get steaming, get chippy, go home. That is to go out and get drunk, and sorry, I'll translate obviously for the transatlantic audience, you know. I have this feeling that they really don't give a fuck. There's bastards on either side of the fence, and they're quite happy to just kind of stay where they are. I guess the main thing is that we had another referendum about 30 years ago. Actually more, maybe about 40, 1978, 1979, we had one, and only 60% of the Scottish populace even turned up to vote, let alone had a strong opinion on the matter. I get the feeling that maybe more will come this time, but actually getting people to leave their house to stop watching TV and go to a polling station is a real big issue in Scotland, and that might haunt us again there.
Yeah, so is there a economic kind of class breakdown between do the poor mainly want independence and the rich mainly want to stick to stay in the union, and the middle class are kind of split between the two depending on where they're loyal?
Not really. I'd say, well, basically in Scotland there's not a huge kind of upper class here. I mean, there is, it does exist, but it's not quite the same as sort of the south of England or anything like that. Obviously, here in Britain, we're obsessed with class. Just, we'll just talk about it for a bit as well, because we are all obsessed with it. But Scotland's historically is quite a working class country, I suppose, when you look at it. It is a working class country, and it's always voted Labour, basically. Always. We never vote anything else until the nationalists go in.
Right.
So the real power lies in if you can get the vote of the working class, which makes up maybe, 85-90% of the people here, people that are like the kind of offspill from the old industries, the shipbuilding, the coal mining, any of the big manufacturing sort of colonial British Empire, heyday industries that now are completely defunct, I've left this, you know, large kind of, working class, I suppose. You can get them on your side, you win this referendum hands down. It only needs to be a 50% swing. I mean, there's no percentage to it apart from just as long as over half say either there are, it's a win. Yeah. The working class in Scotland make up way beyond 50% of the people here. get them on side, and you'd nail it.
And there's been no kind of, the working class is pretty apathetic about this, it sounds like.
I get a feeling they, yeah, as I say, don't really care yeah. as much as could be done. I think, as far as I can work out, the yes vote is would be more beneficial to them, but it's taking a plunge. You know, you are kind of cutting off from England and the rest. It does mean you're gonna face some sort of economic uncertainty. And Scots don't like being deprived of anything they've already got. It's been a historical trait since sort of the Middle Ages, really. But yeah, that's my take on it.
So Ben, have you read anything about this? Do you know anything about this? What's your kind of thoughts on it? What are your thoughts on it?
Sure. Well, I mean, one proposal I've heard is to post independence, sort of copy the Irish strategy, and set yourself up as a little tax haven for Europe. And I think the plan in Scotland is to peg their corporate tax rate like 3 or 4 points below the UK tax rate. I don't think that's going to be a super successful strategy, just because the OECD is pretty dead set on cracking down on tax leakage. And so I think sort of even for Ireland, the heyday of that strategy is coming to an end. I'm curious, Lou, which side do you think is going to win this vote?
To be honest, I have actually no idea how it's going to work. As I say, all polls kind of come out about 50-50 so far. I'd say in my head, the no vote carries just enough certainty. As I say, Scottish people don't like to kind of venture into uncharted territory. This isn't David Livingstone's days anymore. We're pretty long way past that. So I'd say it would probably end up being a no vote. The question is whether if a large enough slice of the population don't vote at all, then it really could go anyway, like either way.
Yeah. And we've talked about that before on here about how the European kind of far right took advantage of low voter turnout in the last European parliamentary elections to kind of sweep in certain places, not all the way into power, but certainly gave them a larger voice than they had before. I'm interested about the fact that the Scottish don't like to lose what they had before, and under a yes vote, they would lose a significant amount of what they had. Not only would they lose the pound, potentially, they would be out of the EU, and they wouldn't have a military any longer to any real degree. The problem with the EU is that you need unanimous for both the EU and NATO. You need unanimous like acceptance in, and a few countries in the EU and in NATO, specifically Spain, would never allow a kind of referendum-based independent country in. Because they have their own independence referendum coming up in Catalonia in the next couple of years. I'm not sure exactly when it is, but Spain would never allow that to happen.
Can anyone explain to me why it is that Catalonia is allowed to vote for independence, but the Basques aren't in Spain?
That's a good question. I have no idea. I think it has something to do with the fact that the Basques have been for a significant amount of time and are kind of, I don't know. Spain, Basques are also in France as well, which might be another part of the issue.
You'd have to know a lot about the regional autonomous Spanish politics, and then you're a winner. However, I can't really add much to the conversation, I'm afraid, there.
Yeah.
The Basques were blowing stuff up in Spain until pretty recently, so maybe that's blotted their copybook slightly in terms of being allowed to, dictate their own sort of autonomy from the Spanish government.
that's kind of what I'm thinking as well. All right, so do we have anything else to add to the Scottish independence topic? I mean, it's coming up soon. There's only so much we can say beforehand in terms of speculation.
I've heard the Americans don't really want Scotland to become independent because, I don't know, I guess we could become some sort of, like, haven for, like, nefarious activities, you know. But Barack Obama, who's sort of your spokesman, and he said that they don't want that to happen. Do you guys have an opinion at all, or do you not care at all? Like,
Ben, you want to go first?
I mean, I don't feel very strongly about it. I think that in a small way at least, I think it would be a shame for the UK to continue to disintegrate. Just because I'd like to see a more cohesive Europe overall right now. This sort of in the wake of the crisis in the Ukraine, I just think that further political division in Europe right now is not a good thing, because I think that in terms of defense and energy policy especially, I'd really like to see a lot more coordination within Europe to sort of firm themselves up, you know, in terms of threats on their eastern flank. Not that, you know, Scotland seceding is a massive blow to that effort, but I think it's might be a step in the wrong direction and symbolically damaging to that. I don't know. Ron, what about you?
Yeah, I'm on similar kind of terms. Just in terms of nostalgia, I think that, which is a completely kind of irrational and not really a good reason to do anything.
Hey, it gets votes. It gets votes.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. The ethical appeal. Emotional appeal. I agree with what Ben said. I think that the EU needs to kind of tighten up a little bit. The problem with that is they're pulling in so many different directions now. Like I mentioned before, the pull to the far right, that nobody in any of those parties wants to be part of Europe. The separation, I mean, it's still there between the pigs and Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain, and the Northern European countries like Germany and the Netherlands and Austria that are kind of bankrolling the EU at the moment. Like you said, Ben, Scotland leaving wouldn't necessarily have any real effect on that, but it would also, Scotland couldn't join the EU just yet. So there's no real advantage for them, I don't think, to split from the UK. The UK is a economic power at this moment, even separate from the EU. And why they would want to kind of try it on their own without really knowing what the effects would be and what the future would be separate, I think is too risky, especially with everything that, I mean, the world's falling apart in a lot of different ways right now, and that's not really an understatement, to say, yeah, we want to be independent and we want to go our own way is risky.
Or we'd be free.
despite whatever Mel Gibson has to say about it.
I put his opinion in the hat, and then we can deal with it then.
Yeah.
Which way are you going to vote, Louis?
What's that?
Which way are you going to vote?
At present, it's hard to say. Yeah. Purely through laziness, I've never re-registered my address in anywhere in the UK. So I still have a, as far as the government is concerned, I still live in Edinburgh, actually. So I will be voting. I will be coming up to cover it anyway, like as a sort of writing point of view, because I think it will be a very interesting outcome. And yeah, could provide a good story to sort of finish off from your, you know, where are the stories? Maybe one will be there. Who knows? Absolutely. We'll see.
Absolutely. Well, we look forward to it. Well, thank you guys both for coming on, Louis, as usual, and Ben. I'd love to have you on again sometime in the future. I don't know, do you have any pieces coming up that you're looking to write or writing?
Yeah, this is great. Keep inviting me. I've got an op-ed. Well, this one, I have one op-ed coming out for the Globe that's purely local, but I have another that I'm just wrapping up. Basically saying that universities should start giving tenure credit to professors who publish open textbooks, not just new research. I'm going to be writing an essay for Politico magazine, sort of taking down all the quackery about millennials, all the articles you read saying millennials are different from their elders because they're more likely to put their heads up their own asses for fun or whatever it is.
You've had a couple of those before, right? A couple of millennial-based ones?
I did one other thing about millennial politics for Politico a few months ago, yeah.
You are the go-to millennial writer on the subject for Politico magazine.
And something about a Chinese middle school fires in Boston, that's come out too. So,
okay.
Lush it.
A lot on your plate.
Yeah.
Good to hear. All right, guys. Thank you guys for coming on, and I hope to speak with you both soon.
Perfect. See you next week, folks. Tune in again.
Bye now.
Check it out, yo. Some people say Connecticut can't rock, but I'm here to make you all hip and hop. It's not about the freak, it's not about the rock, it's a brand new dance. We call it punk rock. It's kind of like the dog, and it's kind of like the chick. Come on, everybody, let me see your body work. But first of all, I'd like to let